Greetings, listeners. You're probably asking yourself, why was that last episode so short? I wanted to hear the rest of what's going on. Well, Luke and I have been talking, and we decided that we're going to start releasing more regular but shorter episodes, somewhere in the area of about 45 minutes each. And of course, we are going to be releasing episodes more frequently, but we've decided that's just best considering the average time we suppose a listener is listening to a podcast at the gym on the way to work. So 45 minutes for history seemed like a very good number. Also, 45 minutes really helps when we have such a dense, well-researched podcast. And don't worry, even though the episodes are going to be short, you're still going to be able to expect the same quality and thorough research and discussion. So that's good. Where we left off in the last episode, Pompey had raised troops with his own private fortune and had already fought off three armies that were sent against him with success in a campaign that otherwise would have led to his total annihilation. So, we continue with our narrative with Episode 3, The Rising Sun, Part 3. Luke, are you there?
Right, and I think, after that first engagement, Pompey really started to change his mind about marching south and joining Sulla. You know, he just basically routed three armies that were sent against him, which by all rational calculation should have just wiped him into the Adriatic. But
and I have an account here that Carbo says, no way. And he sends a large body of horse against Pompey when he's on the move again. And apparently Pompey gallantly routs the enemy, and he drives the cavalry on unfavorable ground where they're unable to form up for another attack, and they pretty much have to surrender.
Right, and I think basically what's important about Carbo's defeat here is this really gave Pompey a valuable haul of armor, horses,
and
also gave him a lot of leverage to use when because at this time, he's really trying to consolidate his area in Picenum. And he really doesn't know how Saul is doing or if Saul is even going to treat him as an ally. At this point, he's kind of acting from a state of not knowing. So basically, these victories are giving him credit in Saul's eyes.
Yeah,
so basically, he's...
Sorry, I'm sorry. No, I love that. Just, you said exactly what I was going to say. Meanwhile, Pompey has no idea how Sulla is doing. It's very reasonable to assume that Carbo is not a complete idiot, which arguably he is. Pompey has no idea how well Sulla is doing, but he does land in Brundisium completely unopposed. He actually makes it most of the way up the Appian Way, as most of the Marians are in the north, before he's even opposed, but Pompey's doing all this, kind of risking it all. If Sulla says, hey, get out of here, kid, three legions are, he may have had a few spectacular successes in the beginning, but three legions are hardly going to be a spectacular leverage lever against the combined forces of the Marians, or now the Sullan parties in Italy.
Right, and, at this time, when Sulla's beginning to march north, he doesn't really know of Pompey's successes either. Metellus Pius offers his services at this point on the Via Appia, and he really starts becoming a legitimizing figure. And at this point, we're told that Cethegus, who is actually a solid Marian, actually switches sides, which we'll see that a lot. We'll see a lot of troops, a lot of people, starting to just switch sides. I really couldn't tell whether Cethegus switch sides at this time or a different time, but I believe Appian puts it in at the same time Metellus Pius switches sides. He has Cethegus switch sides as well.
And here we have that story of Scip, the consul Scipio again, which either he's very unlucky or the ancient sources got it mixed up. But after entering Campania, and refer to the last podcast for our ancient geography, Sulla met with two consular armies. He destroyed the first one, and instead of engaging the second one, he orchestrated a temporary truce with the other. As Sulla had judged, the two armies fraternized with each other. They were communicating, which happened. We're all Romans here. and the enemy army defected over to Sulla's ranks. The commander of the army was the poor consul Scipio. The only people who didn't defect to Sulla was apparently Scipio and his son.
Right, and they were left in a camp. I think this is really interesting because it kind of Sertorius was actually here at this point.
No kidding.
You know, basically, in Campania, we had both Scipio and Norbanus, both consuls of Rome at this time. You know, basically, the brunt of the military might of Rome in the south was in Campania at this time. Consul Norbanus was holding a line at the river Volturnius, and here Sulla and Metellus end up killing 6,000 men with only, we're told, they only lost 70 of their own men. And basically they drove Norbanus back into Capua, which is a kind of near Naples. It's kind of a little bit east of Naples.
I think that deserves a little explanation. We do hear in a lot of the ancient sources and in Caesar's account of the Civil War, which you should really read, listeners. It's really amazing. We hear this, you know, 7,000 men were destroyed, and the victor only lost, you know, 800 men. We're going to have a thorough military podcast episode, but these big discrepancies and dead versus the winning side really comes down to the fighting formation of the legion. And I think in a lot of our imaginations, you see these two armies, you know, crushing back and forth against each other in an exhausting exchange. But from what I understand, a lot of people weren't necessarily massacred during the engagement, but when one side finally tires, surrenders, is routed or outmaneuvered, flees and runs, that is where the real killing starts and where the huge amount of men start to get cut down. So that is probably why the victor typically loses far less than the loser in an engagement. So Sulla soon learns that this kid, Pompey, is fighting off three separate armies. And I would imagine Sulla is pretty eager to embrace anyone who's helping him. He knows he's outnumbered. He knows that he's basically a rebel right now. Illegally or not, he's not the legitimate authority in Rome. And so he rushes right to Pompey's aid.
And basically, you know, that's one of the main reasons why he had Metellus with him. They're going up against the consuls who were the basically elected officials. We had him rout Norbanus, drive him back to Capua. You know, we also had, the consul Scipio, and we were talking about this kind of traitorous move that the army made. Scipio was actually occupying a close by town to the river Volturnus, Antinum, and we're told that Scipio's forces are really demoralized by Norbanus's defeat. So Sulla ends up crossing this river, but instead of attacking, he just pitches a camp and starts opening negotiations with Scipio. And he ends up deciding to really seize the advantage of the disheartened sentiment of Scipio's troops. You know, and he ends up, Scipio ends up collecting hostages from his consul, for his conference with Sulla. And then he ends up sending Sertorius, who's serving under Scipio at this time, to Norbanus to inform him of the negotiations. And this is where Sertorius, we're told, he ends up going and taking a town that's under Sulla's control of Susia. And this becomes a point of hot contention during these negotiations that Sulla is having with Scipio. And Scipio, not knowing how to respond to Sertorius's actions, he ends up releasing the hostages, which we're told, you know, are basically, you know, this becomes an even bigger blow to Scipio's, the morale of Scipio's army. So basically, you know, we're told that after the defeat of Norbanus, Scipio's army was demoralized, and then Scipio making these concessions at their negotiations ends up causing his army to defect en masse. So Sulla was basically able to just wipe out an entire consular army, or basically add his own consular army, take over a consular army at this point, which is gigantic. You know, Sulla ends up sending more envoys to Norbanus to open up negotiations with him, but Norbanus isn't having it. He's pretty much thinking at this point, Sulla's trying to, you know, basically pull a fast one again on him. So, basically Sulla just continues on. He ends up destroying all the hostile territory in front of him, marching along the Via Appia. And we're told Norbanus starts doing the same thing, or attempting to, and Carbo ends up rushing to the capital because Sol is on the move, Metellus is on the move, and we're told he quickly declares all of the Solon allies public enemies. And we're told that this actually coincides with Rome being burnt. We're not really given a good explanation of why Rome is burning at this point. We just know that it does occur, that there's a huge fire in Rome.
This must have been when the Temple of Jupiter was struck by lightning, burned it down. You know, how about that for an omen? The capital, the Sibylline books, some of the Sibylline books were supposedly destroyed in this fire. But before we get to Carbo furiously getting to Rome, there's this little bit from Plutarch I wanted to share with the listeners. So Sulla does learn of Pompey's success against three armies. He must have been confused. Pompey must have been confused. Nonetheless, Sulla rushes north to join with Pompey, and he soon learns the details that not only does Pompey not need his support right now, but Pompey was completely victorious against, well, really those four first confrontations. Plutarch says, Sulla had not yet learned of these successes. In fact, when the first news of Pompey's movements reached him, he had been alarmed at the prospect of having to face so many and such experienced enemy commanders, and was hurrying to his help. When Pompey realized that he was near, he ordered his officers to see to it that the troops were fully armed and drawn up in their proper formations, so that they might make a really fine and brilliant impression on the commander-in-chief. He expected, no doubt, to receive great honors from him, but he received more than he expected. From when Sulla saw him approaching with such a fine array of young, strong men, all happy and elated with their successes, he dismounted from his horse, and after he had been saluted, as was right by the title of Imperator, he greeted Pompey in return by calling him Imperator, too. To win this title, Sulla was at war with such men as Scipio and Marius, and no one could have imagined that he would award it to such a young man who was not even a member of the Senate. His subsequent behavior, too, was in accord with his first show of goodwill. He would rise to his feet when Pompey approached and would uncover his head every time he came into the room, things which one would hardly ever see him doing for anyone, although he had a number of extremely distinguished people in his entourage. All this, however, did not make Pompey conceited. In fact, when Sulla proposed to send him at once to Gaul, where Metellus was in command, he was considered to be doing less than he could with the forces at his disposal.
The Imperator was basically a right that was given to consuls to act with full authority. And there was different kinds of imperatores. And basically these imperatores were, you know, you could have maeus, which gave you the ability to command governors in their provinces. It gave you complete control over the governors in the provinces. Or it could be a very specific imperatore, which would give you basically command to carry out, you know, actions, you know, certain actions in certain areas, you know, without having authority to kind of trump the governors of the provinces. Basically, it was for military action. Being given it was a great honor and a great responsibility, and it basically was one of the highest positions that you could have in the Roman Republic.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Carbo furiously gets to Rome and is elected consul, what do you know, with the young Marius. Now, this is Marius,
right?
Deceased.
I think it's really really crucial to talk about Sertorius at this point, because Sertorius is seeing, you know, the incompetence of Norbanus, the incompetence of Scipio. He's probably informed of the young Pompey's defeat of three armies, then the defeat of basically Scipio at this point, who obviously is not in good control of any of his troops ever, it seems like.
Poor Scipio. Poor Scipio.
And then, you know, he basically routs Carbo himself, takes all of his, you know, weapons and stuff. So basically Sertorius at this point, who we're told is a very able general, he's actually compared to Antigonus, Doson, he's compared to Alexander the Great. Nice. You know, he's compared to, I believe he's compared to Marius. He's basically one of the greatest generals that we'll see that Rome will ever have.
And he just has the unfortunate destiny of
being surrounded by doofuses. I mean, really.
honestly. His brilliant talent. And you'll see him in the coming chapters. He had the unfortunate destiny of using his brilliant command abilities against his fellow countrymen. And as far as Carbo goes, even Carbo gets discouraged by his own repeated losses. I mean, so Carbo gets to Rome. He's elected consul with the young Marius. This would be Marius's son. Marius is, of course, dead. So this is his young son.
Marius's adopted son, maybe his nephew, biological nephew. This wasn't uncommon in Rome to adopt a person as your son so that you could carry on your family lineage, your family honor. But this is basically Marius the Younger. This isn't the old Marius who's died of a heart attack or what have you.
Wow. So, and meanwhile, so, you know, Sulla is not very popular right now in Rome either.
Right, and I think that's one of the crucial aspects of the Metelli being involved in here, because they're really, this family is giving all of the legitimacy to Sulla that he needs, because if he didn't have Metellius Pius at this time, he would not have any of the legitimacy to really do what he's doing. He would be viewed as some kind of usurper, some kind of radical revolutionary. But with the Metelli, he can claim he is the patriot and he's ousting these radicals that have usurped Rome while he's been gone. In this campaign season that reopens with Marius the Younger. Marius the Younger was only 27 at this time. Pompey was what, 21?
23. And the legitimacy 23. Of the legitimacy of having these spectacular families on your side, wasn't just a smokescreen. Pompey is going to increasingly seek political alliance with some of these leading families in Rome again and again in his life, especially for a man who doesn't have tremendous ancestry to boast of on his own.
So basically, you have this in 82, in the spring of 82, you have two theaters of war open, and the Civil War is well underway.
Okay. Yeah, okay, yeah, I thought we might end there, but no, that's fine. Yeah, the campaign season reopens in the spring of 82. In the south, Marius tries to block Sulla in Latium for his advance from Campania. In the north, in Picenum and Umbria, Carbo is pitted against Pompey. Metellus Pius is elected consul in 80 with Sulla. And Marcus Licinius Crassus, who had actually lost his brother and father during the Marian Purge. If you remember when Marius allegedly goes crazy, comes back to Rome, and there's a bloodbath ensues. Metellus is placed in command by virtue of rank of anything. And like we have a brief mention of Plutarch, it is believed by some sources that Pompey was given this command possibly by Sulla, and that he generously acquiesced it to Metellus because of his virtue of rank, who did outrank Pompey being a consular, a proconsul. But you were mentioning some other theory why Pompey might not just be magnanimous. He might have another reason of not taking off probably one of the most powerful men in Rome at the time.
Right, and at this point, the Metelli family is really reaching the apex of their political power in Rome. And, when Metellus Pius, we last hear of him, I believe in 64, I think he probably dies around that time, he's potentially one of the most powerful men in Rome at this point. We're told by Plutarch that Metellus was given command, with Pompey actually talking Sulla out of appointing him. It's really interesting to kind of look at the Metelli family and figure out what exactly is going on here. We're told that Pompey actually talks Sulla out of appointing him, and Pompey actually writes a formal letter endearing himself to Metellius Pius, basically endearing himself to the Metelli family. We're going to learn about a lot of the marriages. Marriages in Rome are really very, very political. They are perhaps, one of the foundational political apparatuses that Romans have, especially among the wealthy class.
Absolutely.
And it's because a lot of the way that the families were set up and the sponsorship was set up. Marius, we are told, was an adfinis, which is one of these sponsored individuals of the Metelli when he went into when he was elected as the when he was the legate of Metellus Numidicus in Africa. And Sulla was also an adfinis of the Metellus family. He was actually a cousin of Metellus Pius. And we're actually told that, so it's really interesting to note that in 81, kind of after the Civil War, you see Sulla being basically forced to divorce Metellia, who is basically the cousin of Metellus Pius. And he ends up having to do this when she falls ill because of the advice of priests. I've heard many sources that have said that, Sulla is a kind of a skeptical man who's superstitious, but not really religious. But we also know from this time period that the priests had a very political role in Rome. And my theory is that, when he was forced to divorce Metella, who was the cousin of Metellus Pius, in 81, right when he's taking control after he wins the Civil War, priests challenge him. So he basically either has to not observe what the priests say, which would be potentially a prosecutable offense to Rome, or he has to divorce himself from the Metelli family, which was his legitimizing force for this. And so,
and of course, sacrilege was a capital offense in Rome.
Right. And so he ends up divorcing her and throwing her out of her, basically his house on her deathbed, and she dies, and we're told that, he celebrates her funeral lavishly. At the same time, he has, Metellus Pius appointed the Pontifex Maximus to replace Gavula, who had died in the Marian prescriptions or Marian, slaughter, I guess.
The Pontifex Maximus?
Yes. So he appoints Metellus Pius Pontifex Maximus.
Who's the head?
And this was basically a political maneuver, in my mind, by Sulla to maintain his alliance with the Metelli, who had probably the lion's share of the political clout in Rome at this time. In 81, Sulla also starts trying to force people to divorce their wives and marry into the Metelli family, and one of these individuals is Pompey. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves right now. Going back to the spring of 82,
Sulla eventually. Go ahead.
Basically, Metellus becomes the commander in the north with Pompey as his legate, and we're told that Pompey invigorates Metellus as molten bronze poured into something that is cold and stiff with age.
Nice.
We're told that his exploits are great and enumerated in the text that Plutarch was working from. However, he said that he didn't want to include them as he wanted to, quote, leave room for Pompey's greater achievements, end quote, in order to better illustrate his character.
And Plutarch also says that Plutarch skips a bit of his narrative here, and he sums it up in a delightful paragraph. And he says, on the subject of not elaborating on Pompey's pretty brilliant early successes, which we don't have a lot of information on. However, just as athletes who have won all the men's events and been awarded prizes at all the games do not make much or even record the victories they won when they were boys, so it is with the deeds of Pompey at this time. They were extraordinary in themselves, but were quite blotted out by the number and the importance of his later achievements in war, and I am afraid to do more than touch upon them, lest I should take up too much space on these early deeds, and so leave myself insufficient room for those actions and experiences of which were the greatest ones that the ones best suited illustrate his character.
Right, and I think, that speaks to kind of what Plutarch was doing. He wasn't really writing history so much as he was writing biographies, and he was really trying to show what virtues and what vices people had that led to their varying, results. So he kind of was doing character studies and less of actual historical documentation.
Yeah, he concentrated a lot on what motivated some of these terrific figures in Rome's antiquity.
Basically now, Sulla is in the south, and him and the young Marius the Younger, are basically stalking each other. Metellus defeats Carinus, which was one of Carbo's officers that we're told that Metellus defeats. So basically, then Carbo attacks himself. Metellus ends up holding up in a city and is besieged.
Sulla eventually defeats Marius in Latium. After Marius is routed, Sulla marches on Rome.
Right, and so basically, Marius is routed at Sacriportus, and then Marius flees to a town called Praeneste, and basically he's put up into this town. He's famously hoisted up the walls in a wicker basket to escape danger. And upon hearing this, Carbo ends up fleeing to Armenium with Pompey on his rear, we're told. And so this basically, when Carbo hears that Marius is now he's now lost in this great battle, Carbo freaks out. Metellus is invigorated, and he's routed.
And Pompey does manage to defeat, in Carbo's retreat, Pompey does manage to defeat a Gaius Marcius, who's one of Carbo's legates. And
At
yes,
Senigallia, yeah.
and the invigorated Metellus manages to defeat another of Carbo's armies. Unopposed, the towns of Italy open their gates to Sulla, and Rome is easily entered. It is soon learned that Antistius has been killed, and his wife is said to have committed suicide when she sees his body floating in the Tiber.
Right, and having your body float in the Tiber, it really goes back to how much Rome really valued the religious aspects. Having your body just thrown in the Tiber was really a sign of disrespect, but it also prevented a proper burial, which prevented religious ascendancy. So it's
And Antistius was Pompey's father-in-law. He was the
right. He was that
praetor.
judge. He was the judge when Pompey was being tried under Cinna and Carbo. We're also told that at this time the Pontifex Maximus Scaevola is murdered. Later, he would be replaced by Metellus Pius, as we talked about. But he had also been a governor in Asia, and I believe we already talked about how his legate Rutilius was condemned by that equestrian jury, which kind of illustrates the point that you were making. Of that now that these equestrians were in control of the courts. It really became a political battle because we know Rutilius was not corrupt, but we know he was basically sentenced at the show trial for being a legate of Scaevola, who's associated with Sulla.
Now, Antistius wasn't killed when Sulla enters the city, who definitely does what he can to liquidate his enemies. Antistius was probably killed by the Marian factions, and like we said, back with Marius's tribune, Marius the Senior, he blots out his political enemies. Sulla comes on Rome, takes care of his enemies. The Marians reinvade the city. They wipe out their enemies, and this is just.
Right, and basically Marius the Younger, when he's in Praeneste, he sends the order to execute all of the Solon supporters in Rome, and that's when all these Antistius dies, Scaevola dies, a number of these people. So we're getting just wholesale massacres at this point, assassinations. You also have Mithridates, which assassinated 80,000 people, right before Sulla even set out for Rome. So you have a lot of assassination. So I couldn't even imagine being someone in this kind of position, in any kind of position in Rome or in the Roman world at this point, because it would really be a paranoid situation.
And I imagine that Mithridates right now is sitting in Pontus with his tail between his legs, but still with his eye on the future, and he's just saying, "Look at these people
Right,
doing this to each
and
other."
basically during this time, actually Mithridates is he's actually starting that Sulla left a individual in charge. We're getting the second of the Mithridatic Wars. Mithridates is remaining in Pontus, but this Roman legate is basically raiding Pontus until Mithridates comes in and defeats him, which allows him to stop. And with this individual that Sulla left in charge of the Mithridatic area, Sulla's telling him to stop, the Senate's issuing orders for him to stop, but he really doesn't until he's militarily defeated, which just goes to show you the kind of behavior that Rome was operating in the East. And that kind of behavior possibly wasn't even approved by the Senate,
And Mithridates says in a famous speech, I think it was in Justin. I wish I had it with in front of me, but I'm not gonna get it, you guys. But Mithridates says in a famous speech that, look at these people. They pride their origins on Romulus and Remus being suckled by a wolf. Dogs and wolves especially were not reverent symbols in antiquity, especially to the Greeks and Romans. They were not popular. They were not seen as clean and noble animals. You know, Mithridates mentions that the rape of the Sabine women. This is a culture whose mythic foundings, their traditional foundings, are based around stories of treachery, of murder. Romulus, of course, murders his brother Remus. The Romans abduct the Sabine women to increase their population. And in the beginning of Rome's foundation, they welcomed exiles, cutthroats, thieves, murderers into their society. And that Mithridates basically says this is a whole civilization that has thrived on taking what is not theirs. So he's...
Right, and you have the second king of Rome, Numa, who ends up installing... He's one of the major religious figures who basically sets up a state religion, and he stops expansion. And he is... They pride themselves on having... be known that he was not a Roman. He was the second king of Rome, and he wasn't a Roman. They really prided themselves in showing that, you know, no matter who you are, you know, in Rome, you can become the most powerful man of Rome. You know, which almost seems like an American kind of value, you know, that we have. You can be whatever you want. You're free. You know, that kind of insinuation. You start seeing a stark difference of that kind of stuff, especially around the Social War, where, you know, it could be a crime to be an Italian impersonating a Roman. It could be a very serious crime.
Well, you have Roman, not even nobles, Roman citizens that are overseas that are abducted, are confronted by a hostile group or a hostile individual. And sometimes, allegedly, it's reported that just to mention that, hey, you know, I'm a Roman citizen. Messing with me is going to bring the vengeance of the empire on you. Was enough to let a lot of Catholics go. You know, supposedly, and I've mentioned before how you have these pretty arrogant senators. They would show up at these petty kingdoms with these petty kings and princes, and it was thought that even the lowest senator, maybe a quaestor, would easily outrank every king in the world. You know, the king of kings like Mithridates, that any Roman senator was above the esteem of any king on earth.
I think we should just finish up with Sulla seizing the possessions of everyone at Rome and putting them up for public sale and putting his troops in front of the Campus Martius, and then having Pompey and Metellus. We'll start the next episode with Sulla, Pompey, and Metellus launching a three-pronged attack on the Marian forces in the north, in Tuscany, Umbria, and the Gallic lands south of the Po. All right. I think that would be a good way to break it up.
All right, in this episode we are finally getting to our hero Pompey, and we talked about how he recruited troops in Picenum, joined up with Sulla, and the civil war continues between the Sullan and the Marian faction. And so do you want to add anything to the end of this?
Yeah, so basically at this point, Sulla, when he gets to Rome, he immediately seizes up all of the possessions of the opposing faction. He puts them up for public sale, and with his troops... he camps out in front of the Campus Martius. At this point, he's in a position to take his, you know, Metellus Pius and Pompey and launch a three-pronged attack on the remainder of the Marian forces, which are now in the north, in Tuscany, Umbria, and the Gallic land south of the Po. So basically, you know, our next episode will be dealing with the second half of the Civil War.
All right, listeners, thank you for tuning in to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast. You've been talking with Alan Keith and Luke Murphy. And please don't forget that the best compliment you can ever give us is to share our wonderful podcast with all your beautiful friends and family. And the best way to comment and show that you like us is to comment on iTunes, Podomatic, or wherever you have this podcast dropped to. Thanks again for listening. Have a nice day.
Thank you very much. Thank you.